And it didn't take long to find. To the left, as I went back in, was an empty stable. I ran my fingers around the wood of its far wall and quickly located an eye bolt and heavy iron ring. I twisted and tugged and something went click, and I was able to swing the door open. Inside was a room with some boxes and a low table. A faint light flickered from overhead, and I looked up to see a wire running from the fixture down to a car battery, a light that automatically came on whenever the door was opened. How convenient. The wooden table was built right up against the wall, and an old kitchen chair was slid underneath. On the wall were thumbtacked photos, old black-and-white pictures that were curling at the edges of Air Force aircraft, KC-135 and KC-10 tankers, and B-47 and B-52 bombers. Squatting in the middle of the table was a dusty shortwave radio and receiver, about 20 or 30 years old, it looked like. Beside it was a desk calendar from 1979. Next to that was a small collection of books, cheap drugstore paperbacks. I opened one and saw rows of numbers, line after line. There were a few books in Russian, the Cyrillic writing looking odd in this place. There was also a small leather-bound notebook, which I scanned. The first brief entry was dated to 1959 and the last to 1981. The handwriting was in Cyrillic, tight and nearly illegible. Maybe it was the dust or the flickering light, but a headache, a powerful one, started throbbing at the base of my skull. To the left, leaning against the wall, was a large pack frame with webbed straps that looked as if it were designed to carry a heavy load, and next to the frame were four wooden boxes, about 2 feet deep, 3 feet wide, and 5 feet long. The covers weren't nailed shut. They had fasteners that allowed the boxes to be opened quickly. I had a pretty good sense of what I would find when I opened the first box. There, nestled in a dry and cracked styrofoam casing, was a long, dark green metal tube, with a handle about a third of the way from one end. There was also a sighting mechanism and a few other odds and ends, and a projectile with fins, about 30 inches long. More Cyrillic writing decorated the tubing. I closed the cover, and it was the creaking floor that saved me. I spun on my feet, ducking my head and raising my left shoulder as Len Malosky charged in, swinging an axe. The blade bounced off my raised shoulder, sliced into my left ear, and struck the wall. Len was shouting something incomprehensible, and I backed away, tripping over the kitchen chair and falling flat on my ass on the barn floor. With a triumphant bellow, he took 3 steps toward me, axe raised high in the air, eyes glaring, face red, mouth twisted in anger, and by then I had frantically dug under my coat and pulled out my 9mm. I pointed it up at him, both hands tied in the approved shooting grip, and snapped back the hammer. The clicking sound seemed to echo in the tiny room, and he paused, axe in midair, the portrait of a frustrated lumberjack. My voice was calmer than I thought possible. "Right now I'm bleeding, Len, and when I'm bleeding I tend to get upset. And when I'm upset my trigger finger gets shaky. So toss the axe out into the barn and I won't be upset anymore. Understand?" He stood there for just a moment, puffing and breathing hard, face still red. Then he tossed the axe where it clanged off the John Deere tractor and said,
"You're trespassing. You're on my property. You get the hell off before I call the cops."
"Sure," I said. "Sounds like a good idea. And when you tell them about the trespasser in your barn, I'll tell them about the Soviet military officer named Leonid Malenkov who owns said barn with surface-to-air missiles and other delights, and who's been in this country illegally for about 40 years. Care to guess who they'd be more interested in?" His eyes flickered to me, and then to the axe, and I knew he was regretting having tossed it. Then he collapsed. His face whitened, his shoulders slumped, and he nodded, a sharp little motion.
"So you've come," he said. "CIA? FBI? What is your name? What do you want?"
I motioned to the kitchen chair. The name is Owen. I want you to sit down on that chair, and then we'll talk. And please don't insult me by thinking I work for either of those agencies. Right now, I'm an independent contractor who's feeling particularly ornery. A couple of minutes later, I had sloppily tied my handkerchief to my left ear, which was throbbing and hurt like hell, but offered the advantage of allowing me to focus my mind. Len sat in the chair, thick hands folded on his lap. I sat on the table next to the radio, gently swinging my legs beneath me as I kept my 9mm pointed in his direction. "Bomber gap, right?" I asked. He looked at me, brow furrowed, eyes unblinking.
"I don't know what you mean."
"Look, this will go a hell of a lot easier if we don't play games, Len. I know your background, your real name." I waved my pistol in the general direction of the hill I had climbed earlier. "You've got half a dozen handheld surface-to-air missiles. They look like an experimental version of the SA-7 Grail, right? And you're living next door to a strategic air command base, supposedly chock-full of nuclear-armed B-52 bombers just waiting for the word to take off and head up over the Arctic Circle and incinerate your motherland." I waggled the pistol back and forth. "Deep cover mission, right? You and probably a couple of dozen comrades, you took up residence near Air Force bases in the U.S., maybe even Britain and Turkey and other places. You wait for the word, and when the word comes, and when those B-52s are rolling down those runways during an alert, you're ready for them. A couple of surface-to-air missiles later, you've got flaming B-52 wreckage everywhere. You and your comrades have taken care of the situation right here in the enemy's backyard." Len was quiet, but his head moved just a bit, as if he were nodding. "Bomber gap," I said. "Back in the 50s and early 60s, the U.S. thought there was a bomber gap, that you folks had more and better bombers than we did. And you know what? There was a bomber gap, but on the other side. We had bigger and better bombers, and your leaders, they must have been scared. They must have looked for something to tip the balance in their favor. Something quick and dirty and cheap. And they came up with you. Am I right?" A quick, almost embarrassed nod, and then he talked rapidly, like he was finally glad to tell someone of what he had done.
"Yes. We were young, committed, all volunteers. We were told it would be a long, hazardous mission, but we did what we had to do. You had us ringed with bases, your NATO, your missiles, your generals boasting of destroying us in a fortnight."
He folded his arms and stared at the far wall.
"We were sworn to secrecy and taken to a remote area in Soviet Asia, near Alma-Ata. We were trained and retrained on how to fire our missiles. We fired them in the air at first, and then at drones, and then..."
He looked up at me.
"Hard to say now, even years later. Last we fired them at aircraft piloted by real pilots. American pilots captured during the Korean War a few years earlier. They were told that if they could fly these jets and survive, that they would go home."
A shrug.
"None did, of course."
I touched the bloody handkerchief on my ear. "Of course. And so you were sent here to wait, and wait some more. What was that like?"
"I lived as a Maine farmer, every day hating this place and its people. Bah! No culture, no sense of family, no real life. Just scratch a living out of this poor dirt and screw your neighbors."
"Why didn't you go home?"
"Home,"
he said, twisting his face as if the word itself was sour.
"First, I have no money for such a trip."
He looked up at me, fists clenched.
"And what kind of home awaits me? The stupid bastards, they gave it all up, all of it, and without a fight."
"Miss the old Soviet Union, do you?" I asked. Len glared at me.
"What do you think, you fool? At one time we were the mightiest empire in the world. We started with nothing, nothing at all. A backward peasant country dismembered by war, and in less than a decade we were making you and your allies tremble. We meant something. We were powerful. We strode across the world stage, and now...
He nearly spat out the words.
Then we gave it all up. And for what? We have a drunken clown as a president. We have whores in Red Square and the Mafia ruling our cities. And that is what we have as we leave this century.
I looked around at the old gear and the radio and said, How long since you've had contact from home? 5 years? 10? A shrug.
That sounds about right.
In case you haven't noticed, your target airbase has been closed for some years now, I said. And the country you worked for doesn't even exist. There are ways of getting money. Why in hell didn't you pack it up and leave? He folded his arms, jutted out his jaw.
Because I am a Soviet soldier. I follow my orders, and my orders are to stay here and keep watch on this base. I cannot predict the future. The old communists may come back into power. This airbase may be used again by your air force. I am not a coward, and I do not shirk my duty. I stay here and follow my orders.
I shook my head. You know, there's a guy I just met that you should talk with. You two would probably get along. Old soldiers from old empires, still fighting in the middle of wreckage and debris.
And you? You are not an old soldier?
At one time I was, but things have changed.
Then why are you here? To arrest me? Bring me back to your superiors?
I lowered my pistol, aimed in his direction. You see, that's the problem. I was sent here to kill you. And with that, I pulled the trigger of the 9mm twice. Back at home and exhausted after my nights and days in the Maine woods, I slept late. After I unloaded the new clothing and toys I had bought up on my way to Cardiff, I went to my little upstairs office and my computer and, remembering certain things that Eric had taught me, did a little research in the wild reaches of the World Wide Web. Mr. Smith was as good as his word and arrived the next day. I watched from my upstairs office, flanked by my new toys, as the dark blue LTD bumped up the dirt driveway, and the two men started walking to the house. Old master and new master. They weren't very different. I waited for the knock on the door before I wrapped some things up and went down to the kitchen. Special Agent Cameron and Mr. Smith stood at the door. The FBI man looking like he was on his way to the dentist, the government man with a large grin on his face. Am I being graced with both of you today? I asked. Cameron said,
I'll wait on the steps.
He sat down gingerly on the stone steps to my house as Smith came into the kitchen. We sat at the table and I said, Later this morning someone's coming to pump out my septic tank. And I'd rather spend the time looking into my septic tank than at you, Mr. Smith. So let's make this quick. He smiled, self-satisfied.
You did well. Very good.
I made a show of looking surprised. Surveillance. You guys were watching me. A happy nod.
That we were.
Your folks were good. Didn't notice a thing.
They're the best.
And what did they notice? I asked. Smith leaned back in the kitchen chair, the old wood groaning under his pressure.
They saw you conduct yourself well, performing a surveillance of the property for 3 days. They saw the target return early, and they heard 2 gunshots. Then they saw you back up the target's pickup truck to the barn, stuff him in an old feed bag in the rear of the truck, and then drive out at about midnight. On a bridge spanning the Quibunk River, you dumped your load, returned to the property. Then you left. Our team moved in, checked the bullet holes in the wall and the blood on the floor. We also found the evidence of the target's connection to Soviet military intelligence. Like I said, nicely done. There was even a typewritten note for the mailman, asking him to take care of the dog. You're an oldie and a softie, Owen.
I kept my hands steady on the top of the table. So I did a good job for you and your government friends, killing an old man who's no longer a threat to this country. The chair came down with a thunk.
Owen, in our little agency, we decide who's a threat or not, and then we decide what to do. And in this case, you did exactly as we asked by killing that old man. Very good.
Really? I asked.
Not bad at all. In fact, we may extend our little agreement with you. Have you perform a few other unusual tasks?
My voice was flat. In other words, you want to hire a killer.
If you want to be blunt.
I looked down at the table, slowly shook my head. Sorry, I'm not feeling well and I have to go to the bathroom. I looked up and said, being retired and all, sometimes your body betrays you. He waved a hand in the air.
Sure, you run along. We'll talk in a few minutes.
I got up from the kitchen table and went upstairs. 10 minutes later, I flushed the toilet and went to the head of the stairs. Smith, I called down. Come up here for a moment, will you? I went into my office and was rummaging around in the closet as he came in and looked at my bookshelves and my humble computer, humming along on my desk. I came out of the closet with my 9mm and in one snap-quick motion I inserted the barrel into his left ear.
Hey!
He said, hands raised. With my free hand, I put a finger to my lips. Shush, I said. Come over here and sit down. That's right, in front of the computer. We moved slowly and I tried to keep everything focused, for I could feel something from him, a coiled sense of energy like a rattlesnake ready to strike. I said, In less than 5 minutes, Smith, you'll be free to go. But if you try anything sneaky, anything at all, I'll blow your damn head off. Understand?
You'd be in a world of hurt,
he said, no longer smiling. Not really, I said. I don't think Special Agent Cameron would miss you that much, and in this country, I would only have to explain to the police and my neighbors and a couple of lawyers how I came to shoot a trespasser in my house. Perhaps I'd get a stretch, but in less than a month everything would be back to normal again, except that salesman wouldn't dare come down that driveway. Have a seat. He did, settling himself heavily into the chair. I pushed the pistol into his ear just a little more for emphasis, and I said, Take hold of the mouse and double-click on that little icon in the upper left-hand column. Smith did, and through the connection of the pistol against his head, I felt his body tense up.
What the hell is this?
He demanded, his voice a step above a strained whisper. Oh, I'm quite proud of it, I said. This is my very first web page. See the nice headline about a government conspiracy to murder old Soviets? Pretty catchy, don't you think? And right below that are a half a dozen little thumbnail pictures of you, Smith, as you came up to my house a while ago. Digital cameras are amazing, aren't they? You can process and download pictures instantly, and you'd be surprised at what you can do with a microphone, some long wire, and a cassette recorder. See those little speaker icons on the bottom? Double-click on the left one, why don't you? His hand moved grudgingly, and after the little snap-snap of the mouse came Smith's voice, coming from my computer's twin speakers.
Owen, in our little agency, we decide who's a threat or not, and then we decide what to do. And in this case, you did exactly as we asked by killing that old man. Very good.
I took a deep breath, feeling that intoxicating rush of putting everything on the line against a dangerous foe. To repeat something you said, first time we met, the clock is running. You don't have any time for arguing. This page is up and active. I've posted messages to a dozen internet discussion groups, inviting them to check out my webpage. And every second you argue, every second you try to wiggle out of what's going on, that means dozens and hundreds and thousands of visitors are going to see your lovely face and hear your thoughtful words. Think your bosses will be impressed next time they do your employee evaluation?
What do you want?
He asked, and as his shoulders sagged, I knew I had won. I close down the web page, and you leave here and never come back, and none of your friends ever bother me again. Agreed?
Agreed?
He said with about as much enthusiasm as a man agreeing to have a toenail removed with a chisel. Oh, I said, one more thing. Stop bothering Special Agent Cameron. He's no friend of mine, but I'm used to him. I pulled the pistol out of his ear and stepped back. He stood up, his face mottled red, his fists clenched.
Agreed.
I went over to the computer, double-clicked that, downloaded this, and in a moment the screen was blank. Smith said,
"You bastard."
I smiled. "That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me." Outside, as Smith stomped his way over to the parked LTD, I said to Cameron, "A moment of your time, Agent Cameron?" He looked over at me with tired eyes, and for the first time since he had first come to check up on me, I felt sorry for him.
"Yes? What do you want?"
What I wanted was to sit him down in my kitchen and talk to him, to find out what he saw in his mind's eye, his memory of that awful time in Waco, and what happened that caused the torching of scores of people, setting off fuses that killed hundreds of more people, and to find out how he made it through, day after day. But I said, "You owe me." A slow nod.
"You may be right. What do you have in mind?"
I told him. He thought about it for a moment, cocked his head.
"You got a deal," he said.
The LTD's horn blew twice as Smith leaned over and hammered the steering wheel, and Cameron managed a wan smile as he walked away. "I don't envy you the ride back," I called out.
"Actually, I'm looking forward to it," he said.
2 days later, I was driving north, Miriam at my side, holding my hand. She said,
"I know Eric's big enough to hold down the store and close it up by himself tonight, but damn it, I don't like being kept in the dark like this."
"In a few minutes, all will be revealed," I said, driving easily with one hand. "I have a secret plan, my dear."
"You do?"
she asked, eyes a touch playful.
"And what's that?"
I squeezed her hand. "If I told you, it wouldn't be a secret, now would it?" She shook her head, muttered,
"You,"
and looked out the window. But she didn't take her hand away. After a while of driving, I turned right into the parking area of a small airport. The familiar sign said, "Fearless Ferns Flying Service." She looked over at me, surprised.
"What are we doing here?"
"You'll see soon enough," I said. We got out of my truck and I grabbed her hand again as we walked around a small hangar. A Cessna was waiting, engine grumbling, propeller turning, and a bearded man standing under the wing nodded at me and I nodded back. Miriam tried to say something, but I pretended the noise of the engine was too loud. A few minutes later, seated in the rear and with headphones on and seatbelts fastened, we were in the air, the bearded man piloting.
"Owen,"
she said to me, her voice static-filled over the intercom system.
"What's this all about?"
I gently reached over and grasped her hand. "It means a number of things. It means you and I are going to Portland tonight for dinner and to see a musical. We'll also be spending the night at a beautiful bed and breakfast near the harbor." And savoring the new agreement I had with Cameron, I added, "Why don't we plan on getting away at least once every month, and you can name the place?" She nodded, blinked hard a few times, and then looked out the side window. She held my hand all the way until we landed. Some nights later, I was in my pickup, engine idling. Next to me, a small rucksack in his lap, sat Len Molosky, or Leonid Malenkov, if you prefer.
"My ears are still ringing from when you shot at me,"
he said, looking out across at the barn where he had lived in the upstairs loft for the better part of a week. "You're a farmer, Ever hear the proverb of how a farmer gets a mule to pay attention? Even in the darkened truck cab, I could tell that he was grinning.
Yes, I have. You strike him over the head with a wooden plank.
So consider those two shots wax over the head, Len. I had to make you understand that you'd be noticed, and that the next guy to come to your farm wouldn't be as thoughtful or as charming as I was. Frankly, all that talk about being a good Soviet soldier was a bit boring. The man sighed.
Perhaps you are right, but after decades of keeping such a secret, I had to talk and talk, and I had to convince you and myself that what I did was right. I had to know that these years had a purpose, that they were not a waste.
Did it work? Another sigh.
No, I do not think so. When you spread your blood on the floor, told me to play dead so that you could put me in the truck in a feed bag, and when you dumped your camping gear in another feed bag and threw it into the river, I was humiliated. A man who was supposed to be my enemy was trying to help me. Why did you do that?
I rubbed at the steering wheel. It was a long war, the Cold War. There had to be an end to it. The last two soldiers coming to an understanding. It just made sense. That's all I can say. I reached into my coat pocket, pulled out a thick envelope, and passed it over. Here, inside's a goodly amount of cash. Pay me back whenever you can. About a half mile down this road is the center of town. There's a Greyhound bus station. Bus leaves in an hour to Portland. From there, well, you can go anywhere you want. But if I were you, I might head to New York City. Go to a place called Brighton Beach. There's a lot of Russian emigres who live there. You might find a way to get home if you ask the right people.
This money, this is charity, and I cannot...
Oh, shut up. You're still a marked man, and it's in both our interests that you get the hell out of here, all right? Now get, before you miss the bus. Len waited for a moment, and then the envelope rustled as he packed it into his rucksack. He held out his hand to me.
I never forget. Do svidaniya.
Do svidaniya to you too. He got out of the truck, a stranger in an odd land, and I watched him as he walked down the road, rucksack on his back. I thought about what lay ahead of him, a bumpy bus ride to Portland, then another long ride to New York, to a city full of strangers. Then, who knows? Perhaps he would try to make a living with the rest of the emigres in that crowded city. Perhaps he would go home, try to adjust to a motherland that had changed so much. It seemed inevitable that he would face poverty and loneliness, with no one to care where he went or where he stayed. I started up my truck and headed back home. God, how I envied him.